Okay, thank you for your practice. Very nice to sit with all of you again. Okay. Some of you may not have been able to hear the bell. I used a small rin this time. In fact, the first time I rung it, it was very clear to me that no one had heard it. And then I picked it up and moved the location of it. The bell that I normally use is more like a small gong, and it has a deep resonance. And so I guess today was a test, and I know that I need to use that one next time. As I mentioned before, I want to now explore more with words and reflections and ideas of my own, and also with some sutta passages that reflect more closely the Buddha's thinking on the topic of refuge. And afterwards, we can talk a little bit about the brief meditation instructions and some attempt on my part and certainly on your part to consider the notion and the possibility of refuge in your meditation practice. I think we're always doing that when we sit down to practice, to meditate, whether we're cognizant of it or not, whether it's at the forefront of our intention or not. The practice is presented to us in the teachings as a refuge, a sanctuary, a place of safety. And we sometimes have that experience in our own practice. We also sometimes have that experience in daily life. We find that we are drawing from some insight or experience we've had through our efforts as a meditator, and that we are somehow protected from others or the world or from our own, shall we say, unskillful behavior. When I was talking with Jim recently, and I checked in with Jim and asked if it was okay to mention our conversation, and he said that it was. When I was talking to Jim recently, he explained some of the challenges that he's been facing and exploring, and very explicitly filtering, in my experience, through his practice and the teachings of the Buddha. And so now, in this portion of the talk, we'll get into all of Jim's challenges that he's been going through. No, we'll leave that part out. But he, you know, with a lot of humility and candor, and just very plainly said, there's this piece and there's this piece, and you know, they're difficult, and I was noticing that though some of those incidents that he was reporting would certainly be challenging, there was a fair amount of equanimity and not so much inflated self in the way he was communicating. And then at the end he said, and my practice is, I have continued to find that my practice is very much still a refuge. And it was one of those sweet moments as a meditator and as a teacher, and just seeing so simply and so plainly the fruit of the practice. Life continues to throw up in front of us and within our lives innumerable challenges. And when we are free from them, it's really a temporary respite to some extent. And then, you know, somewhere down the track, there's another challenge, there's another difficulty. And I think it's that maturation over time that both exemplifies the Dharma and reinforces for us that it's working, right? There's a sense of, you know, this is hard and there are moments when I'm okay within that difficulty. So refuge is a place of safety. We could maybe consider the image or notion of a sanctuary, maybe even a shelter, where we're sheltered or protected from something. And there is, in our tradition, a formal implication for monks and nuns, and to some extent, depending on individual interest, lay practitioners such as ourselves also, that is to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And there are ceremonies for this. I took refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in my early 20s, maybe in my mid-20s. And we could say that it's sort of like being baptized. You know, you're entering into a particular stream of practice, of thinking, a way of being in the world. It was explained to me once that once I took refuge on any of these forms where it says religion, you can no longer write not applicable. You know. So you're sort of signing up for something in a way. Taking refuge in the three gems or the three jewels, a Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, I think of it as a way of organizing our life. It implies a value system and also potentially a structure if you want it to. And it offers clues as to how we might spend our time. In other words, as we define Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha continuously, consistently through reflection, conversation, study, practice, we find that it's not quite what we thought it was, or that it's more nuanced than that, and is certainly not restricted to its textual or literal definition or translation. It has layers and layers and sublayers of meaning. We might very well spend our time cleaning the floor and going to work and trying to find a suitable partner or dealing with health issues or learning a craft or paying our bills. And so in a literal sense, our whole life is not structured according to the three gems. Well, at the same time, as practitioners electing to participate in a contemplative tradition, we are invited to see how these activities, all of these and any of these daily activities, overlap with the three jewels or the three gems, or how our consideration of our adherence to our examination of the three gems might be done through those activities. essentially trying to eliminate that division between practice and everything else. In some cases, we are asked to evaluate if our activities support refuge or take away from it. To a certain extent, though, as we will see in the following passage from the Dhammapada, a limited extent, refuge does suggest going somewhere. But also, it somehow is right here. It is a place, but it is not a destination, which sounds a bit like a Zen koan, maybe. It is a place, but not a destination, because refuge is found within the present moment. You can arrive at the present moment by going somewhere. You cannot arrive at the present moment by going somewhere, because you're already there. As soon as you try to get the present moment, or to get to the present moment, you've left it behind. And this is happening all the time. We're always, as I often say, departing from the present moment. And we notice that in our meditation. We see that. That having been said, we are not in the if we are not in the present moment, we don't have true refuge. So there's the refuge that's easy to understand, such as going to a particular place in a particular room in your house and leaving your checkbook and your to-do list and your tablet and your laptop and your watch that rings like a telephone and all this stuff, you leave it somewhere else. And you go to this quieter place that holds the possibility of a simpler experience of yourself in your life. And that somehow protects you. It somehow protects your mind. And then there's the possibility of the mind itself being an actual refuge, or the principles and insights, the wisdom contained within the Dhamma, that is a kind of refuge, a place we abide, a particular kind of seeing, and we abide there. That's the place, that's the space we occupy. In the Dhammapada, it is written, they go to many a refuge, to mountains, forests, parks, trees and shrines, people threatened with danger. That's all of us. That's not the secure refuge. That's not the highest refuge. That's not the refuge having gone to which you gain release from all suffering and stress. But when having gone for refuge to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, you see with right discernment the Four Noble Truths. Stress, the cause of stress, the transcending of stress, and the Noble Eightfold Path, the way to the stilling of stress. That is the secure refuge, the highest refuge. That is the refuge, having gone to which you gain release from all suffering and stress. As diligent practitioners who commit to this practice over days and months and years, we eventually, even if only occasionally, we stop taking refuge in greed, hatred, and delusion. And our capacity to do that increases. Through carefully cultivating our mind, we more naturally take refuge in wisdom, kindness, and compassion. We abide in those mental spaces. And it feels different, right, to abide in metta or compassion or wisdom. And we can imagine, and we probably all have our own evidence of other people experiencing us differently when we are abiding in those places. And our in the perceptual field within we live probably feels very different. There's probably a very different reality. Life is probably quite tolerable, if not something far greater than that. So there's this possibility that through our way of being in the world, we start to expand and radiate this notion of refuge. We somehow become safer to be around, more agreeable, more pleasant to be around. So we do this by first taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, by practicing, by hearing the teachings, by spending time reflecting on the teachings, by affiliation with like-minded people, other people who are practicing, other people who prefer a path of working against greed, hatred, and delusion. We practice in a lot of different ways. We stop and we sit and we put our many tasks aside. We renounce our many distractions for a certain amount of minutes, a certain amount of hours, and sometimes for days. You know, Frank asked me earlier today, I forget the way Frank framed the question, but it was something like, how did you deal with your interest in being a monk when you were younger? How did you resolve that? And I said, well, I didn't really completely resolve it. It's still there, or the aspirational qualities of that archetype sometimes get very, very strong. And I feel at odds with the burdens of normative or conventional life. And what I didn't say and what I reflected on later was that I also dealt with it over the years and still deal with it simply through getting up in the morning and going to a certain spot. Right now it's this place where you often see me. Alone, and I sit. And sometimes I only have 30 minutes, and sometimes I sit for 3 hours. And over my 25 years of practice, I didn't always have this little room here, but I always had some space. And sometimes I would sit all day. I would sit and watch, even not at a retreat center or a program. I was doing that too. And sometimes I would do that for 3 days or 4 days. So I would step outside the momentum and responsibilities and equally important expectations of a conventional or normative life. And I would do these, I would take on these traditional practice forms that, you know, in some cases are very old, and experiment with ways of taking and finding refuge, right, within myself, within the practice, which at a certain point don't have anything to do with the Buddha or Buddhism or any ism, right? Ultimately, at a certain point, there's just a quiet mind and a certain type of perspective that we call insight or understanding. And it changes how we perceive reality and relate to our own life, relate to other people. The sense of refuge, which I was trying to tease out in my brief meditation instructions, the sense of refuge, its presence or its absence is a way of gauging or evaluating our practice. Are we trying to get somewhere? Are we hoping our practice will relieve some trouble within us? Or are we content right here in this moment? And within ourselves. It's fine if we're not. While at the same time, it begs the question, what do we want from our short, precious life? Or what do we want from this morning? You can ask yourself that when you wake up in the morning to meditate. What do you want from this next hour? What do you want from the next 20 minutes? Or from the next few hours before you go to sleep, tonight, for example. What is the value you place on freedom and contentment? And is that demonstrated in how you choose to spend your time, the activities that you engage? We have such limited time, both today and throughout the course of the rest of our life, the end of which is so uncertain. Sometime within the past, I'm going to guess year and a half or so, I got in this habit, this practice, which feels really healthy and has something to do with a new way of making decisions. I'm making decisions not based on past models of decision making, even ones that work. I'm trying not to do a lot of analysis or even healthy critical thinking. I've been relating to my own life more based on the answer to the simple question, how does my mind and body feel? So getting outside of notions of right or wrong or successful or where I should be in my life, and just the sense of how do I want my mind and body, how do I want to experience my mind and body? To what degree am I occupying a refuge? What degree am I a refuge for myself? I identify fairly easily, I think I can say that, and on most occasions with Jim. You know, sitting is often a lovely experience in of being with myself and with the sensory world that I am amongst and part of. Meditation is a relatively quiet and slow time where I'm free from coming and going and free from evaluating and achieving. There is often simply whatever there is, this sound or this breath or this passing thought, this emotion, all these things rising and passing away, with spaces of deep stillness between them, moments of real profound refuge. And it took a long time to get there. There's not so much striving. And yet I've still learned certain techniques. So the techniques are there, and then in the absence of striving, something happens. Something is eliminated. And we find ourselves in this very refreshing, appealing space. These skills that we learn in formal practice are how we relate to and hold what is coming at us in daily life, both from others and from within our own mind and body. We use formal practice, meaning sitting down and meditating, to cultivate a way of being. And we endeavor to be that same way after the bell rings and we resume our daily activities. And if we can't do that, we should reevaluate our practice, and or we should reevaluate our daily activities. So this is something you can check for yourself. Does your ability to remain present end when the bell signals the end of meditation? Does your conditioning come rushing in before the tone of the bell even stops, right? Kristen and I were talking about this afternoon. I told her that I thought I would talk tonight about refuge, and we talked a little bit about it, and she said, oh, it's like a rest area where you stop for gas, and where you pull over. It's like a rest area where you pull over, she said, and you can get gas. And so when I thought about this, about how a rest area implies a literal stopping of movement, it makes quite a bit of sense, and I started to really like the image. A rest area is also, as we discussed, as Kristen and I discussed, a place to get snacks and hydrate. It's a place to get fuel, right? So in the sense that it provides nourishment, we could say, it's like refuge in the Dhamma. Really, we're feeding ourselves somehow. Kristen also said that you can take a pee at the rest area. At which time I think maybe our conversation might have veered off track a little bit. Or perhaps I was not witty enough to correlate taking a pee with Dhamma practice. I still don't know about that one. But perhaps this might be a stretch, but perhaps I was going to say perhaps we also empty ourselves at the rest area like we do in practice. Where this particular conversation became really interesting for me was when Kristen pointed out that one doesn't stay at the rest area, but gets back on the road. And I wasn't sure about that. And I had to think about that a little bit after Kristen and I hung up. And I think there are two ways we can think about this. On the one hand, we don't sit in quiet solitude forever. We return to the road, to our life. And frankly, it doesn't matter how much we sit. We're probably not always going to be in touch experientially with this notion of refuge. That's fine. So we return to the road, to our life. However, on the other hand, like many monks and nuns who take a lifetime vow, literally taking refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, we do aim to become a refuge unto ourselves. to embody the full meaning of the term and the practice. I do think that's an aspiration. I think it's a realistic one. In the Digha Nikaya, and this is a bit of a, I don't want to say controversial, but people are not, teachers and students are not identified so strongly with this passage anymore because I think partly because of misinterpretation, in that being that it is read often as a denial or dismissing of the importance of relationships, but that's not really what's being advocated for here. Make an island of yourself. Make yourself a refuge. There is no other refuge. Make Dhamma your island. Make Dhamma your refuge. There is no other refuge. So to be secure and independently free without external support or motivation is not to be independent from others. It's not to leave others behind. That is not implied here. It means that we become in a way self-sufficient, self-knowledgeable, self-secure. I think as Westerners, we are often inclined to see this whole thing of Dharma as hard work. And there are times when it is exactly that, though ultimately being free is not something that we would readily and agreeably give up, you know, for a normative way in the world. To get a taste of the Dharma is to have the Dharma eye, and to see differently going forward. We can't go back to the same level of not knowing once we have the Dhamma eye. We can't go back to the same level of ignorance. So life is hard and we need a refuge, right? The Dharma is providing a very good one for us. Kristen said, if one is paying attention, life is hard and scary. And she added, frankly, maybe a bad idea. Bad idea or not, we're here. We're living this hard life. And I think we come to practice to smooth that out a little bit, right? To find a refuge for ourselves. And I'll close with a relatable image also from the Pali Canon. Simply, those to whom the Dhamma is clear, they walk evenly over the uneven. Those to whom the Dhamma is clear, they walk evenly over the uneven.